So as many of you know, for the past few months, I've been meeting with some folks in Barrie who are talking about the housing issues in central Vermont and trying to determine what to do next. This conversation came out of or started because of the incredible congestion and overflow of the Good Samaritan Haven, which is the homeless shelter in Barrie, and sort of wondering about what to do with that program and how to help the fact that there are way more people than they can possibly house there. And so we've been puzzling this out, and there's a lot of roadblocks, and it's very frustrating and intimidating and daunting because there are so many struggles and so many obstacles to overcome, and it's a huge, daunting task. We know that there are about 200 people without housing, completely without housing, in Washington County, and that there's probably another 50 or so that can be counted who have, you know, couch surfing or have a place to stay but not housing of their own. That's a low number that of people who were counted by the state during their point in time survey. So this is a huge problem. Good Samaritan Haven, the only homeless shelter in Washington County and in central Vermont, can provide sleeping space for about 25 of those people. And that's it. I think there's room for about, it's 28 beds, and there's always overflow, people sleeping on the floor of the common room and so on. Well, this past week we heard from one of the women affiliated with the Upper Valley Haven, and the pictures that you're seeing there are a couple of pictures from their website about their program. The Upper Valley Haven is the homeless shelter and then some in White River Junction, or the region called the Upper Valley by the folks who live there. But unlike the Good Samaritan Haven, this is a program that's grown a lot over the 30 years that it's been open, and is now really quite enormous. In addition to being a shelter, it is also the food pantry, or one of the primary food pantries for that region. So start to combine the Good Samaritan Haven and the food pantry, and you'll start to get a sense. It's also a distribution center for free clothing, so we add that in, and you get a sense of how big this program is starting to be. There are not daycare programs, but after-school childcare programs, and homework clubs, and things to help children, because about half or more of the folks who stay at the Upper Valley Haven are children. And this shelter, which is in two buildings, has an adult dorm kind of building that in 10 rooms can sleep 20 single adults in bunk beds kind of things. And in sort of two pods, they call it, has a family shelter, four families each. So a total of eight families, and the two pairs of four families, the one set of four families will share a kitchen and a common area. But they have two rooms each per family to themselves. And so all told, it's eight families, 20 adults in addition to that, and then some child care programming. There's also adult education, resume writing assistance, application for programs and assistance programs and things that people might be eligible for. There's all kinds of stuff going on. How to present yourself in a job, how to build a rental reference or resume so that you might be able to get into housing in the long term, and so on and so forth. And, you know, all of us folks from Barrie and Montpelier are sitting there, you know, with our mouths hanging open, drooling at the prospect of this project. I mean, it's just this phenomenal thing, this incredibly comprehensive program that really tries to help people who otherwise would be living in cars and under bridges and couch surfing and tenting and things like that, and really try to bring those folks who are interested and committed to it, to give them the resources they need to work with them, build a relationship with a person so that they can trust one individual who's going to help them through a process. They have two people whose sole job it is to listen to a person's situation and then make phone calls with them, fill out forms with them, help them navigate the maze out there. There are resources for people who need them, but to navigate those resources, you need a map. and you need a person who knows the system, and you need a hand to hold and someone to trust rather than going to 25 different agencies and bouncing around voicemails and getting the runaround from different folks. They're able to provide two people whose job it is to kind of one-on-one work with a person in relationship in a respectful, trusting way and help them do this. So all told, there are about 20 staff members for the Upper Valley Haven, some full-time, some part-time. And there are a further about 260 volunteers or something huge, astronomical like that. To be a volunteer, you have to work 4 hours a month or more. So it's not like, you know, you've dropped something off once and you're considered a volunteer. These are folks who regularly help out 4 hours a month or more. And the budget for the Upper Valley Haven is $1.6 million annually. And we all went, oh, well, that explains it, because we can't do that. Where'd you get your funding from? And they said, well, 15% of it comes from state and federal grants and programs and assistance, and 85% of it comes from donations. 85% of $1.6 million budget comes from that community's donations. Churches, businesses, community groups, and individuals who just have learned, have decided, have figured out that this is how they can help their community. This is how they can be a good neighbor, is by supporting a program that's making a real difference in the lives of adults and families and children, that's sustainable, that's helping people get back on their feet and get into long-term housing. And the community supports this, not any one church or one organization or one state agency, but 85% of their funding comes, they have now two of their staff people are development and fundraising folks, and their job is to get the community behind this program and keep the support going. And so just recently, just within the past year, they built that second dorm, the singles adult dorm, and almost tripled their budget in the process of doing that to the point where it is now. And they continue to have the support of the community in this process. And we were just blown away. They know who their neighbors are. They know that their neighbors are not people to be despised or demonized or stigmatized. They know that the folks who need help in their community are not, for the most part, bums and drunks and transients and people who are lazy or whatever. But that for the most part, while there might be people who seem to fit into some stereotypes, for the most part, the folks who need help in their community are children and families, single parents or individuals, people who've lost their job and were living just one or two paychecks away from the streets and so ended up there. They understand that quite literally there, but for the grace of God go them. And they've determined as a community, then the Upper Valley region defines itself, both Vermont and New Hampshire, on both sides of the Connecticut River, they've determined that their job in being neighborly is to help one another. So history lesson time. A good 600 years before Jesus lived, the Babylonians, in a long string of people who had done so, the Babylonians conquered Israel, Judea, Jerusalem. The Babylonians destroyed the temple, and they carted off to Babylon the ruling class of the Jewish folks that they conquered. They didn't bring everybody. They didn't have to. They brought the monarchy, you know, the royals, the ruling family. They brought the religious leaders and the temple authorities, having destroyed the temple anyway. They brought the educated folks, the powerful folks, the people who had money, land, power, wealth, position. And they carted all those folks off to Babylon, where they lived for about a generation, and where we get some of the most evocative poetry and expression of the Hebrew Bible. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion, right? And so in captivity, the sort of leadership of Israel and what becomes the tradition of Israel survives in this captivity to return. What we don't hear about are the folks who got left behind. They were kind of already left behind because they were the people who didn't have money, didn't really have land, didn't have power, didn't have privilege or education or anything to call their own. And so all of the top level of society gets ripped away and we leave these poor folks behind. And so what do? Well, they tend the land. And they have no temple, so they develop their own kind of hybrid worship system, where because there's no temple, they build some shrines on the mountaintops and they blend their worship a little bit with the folks around them, but they still believe that they're worshiping the same God. They're still worshiping Yahweh. And they build these shrines up on the mountaintops and they kind of form their own version of religion. And they try to hold together as best they can because there's nobody to direct them or organize them or support them anymore. And so they just kind of subsist and live as best they can. And a generation later, all the people of power come back from Babylon. And they reclaim the land that belonged to their ancestors. And they boot out the poor people that were living on it. And they reestablish the temple and its leadership. And they name as heresy the worship that was developed in their absence. And they push those folks out to the outer regions, to places like Samaria. And that's actually where the Samaritans came from. The Samaritans are not different people. They're not another race of people, although by the time of Jesus, half a dozen generations later, they think they are. But if you were to stand a Samaritan person and a Jewish person next to each other, even the two of them would have a hard time telling one another apart until they opened their mouths and started talking about their life experience and how they worshiped and how they lived and what their heritage was. But in a sense, they are one people. In some ways, nobody can demonize and polarize quite like we can within our own bodies, right? And so now all of a sudden we have this sort of second class group of people. Now forgive my metaphor if it hits too close to home, but it's as if we took all the folks involved in, say, the government of the state, and all the people who had power and privilege, and we put them in one town. And then in another town, right next door to it, we put all the people who are just coming out of the Department of Corrections and just coming out of Washington County Mental Health and all the people who couldn't afford to live in the place where all the politicians live and work because it's too expensive, and we put all those folks in one place, and then we said, now don't go to Barrie, because that's where all the riffraff is. And I know some of you live in Barrie, so I'm not calling you riffraff, but, right? There becomes a stigma. There becomes a right side and a wrong side of the tracks. There becomes a way in which we say, well, if you're walking down the road in Montpelier, you're not going to get beat up by robbers or mugged or left to the side of the road. But if you're walking down the road in Barrie, well, walk at your own risk. There are meth labs down there. There are homeless shelters down there. There are transition houses for people coming out of prison in there. We don't want to go there, right? And it's almost as if people who look exactly the same, act exactly the same, have the same history, but are divided on a class distinction. And all of a sudden, we can demonize. All of a sudden, we can write letters to the editor in the Times Argus and say, oh, well, you know, it's those Barrie folks. It's the poor people. It's the Section 8 folks. They're the ones to blame. And we get this striation in our society. We're not that different. So a man, and by this I mean a man from a good part of town, or as Jesus would have meant, a Jewish man, because when we're talking about race and class distinctions, whenever we don't give a modifier on it, we know it means somebody like us, right? So if I were to say, in this setting, if I were to say, you know, there was this man over here, and then a black man came up to him, well, now you know that the man who over here was white, because I didn't say so. Or if I said this pastor over here and then another pastor who was a female pastor came over, well, you know, that first pastor was a man because that's the norm and I didn't say otherwise. Or this woman and her kids came to the playground and then a poor woman came up. Well, then you know that the first woman was middle class. Not rich, I would have said rich because we're not rich either. It's not to make us feel bad about the way we are when we talk about race and class, but that's what we do. We name people and just say a person when we mean someone like us, and then we put a modifier on it when we mean someone else. So Jesus is Jewish, and his audience is Jewish, so he says a man is walking down the road, and we presume a Jewish man. It's not important to Jesus, the identity of this victim. That's interesting. Usually the identity of the victim is really important to Jesus. We'd expect the victim in this story to be a Samaritan, wouldn't we? a person from Barrie. You know, there was a poor person on Section 8 walking down the Barrie-Montpelier Road, and the question is whether or not we thought we were too good to stop and help. That's the question. That's not this story. The story is not about the man walking down the road. It doesn't matter where he's from. We assume he's just a regular average person, meaning someone like us or someone like Jesus' audience. And he's walking down the street. He's walking down the Barrie-Montpelier Road, and he's mugged and beaten up and left on the side of the road. We also don't know who mugged him. Although when we see it in the paper, we're probably going to assume that it was one of those folks from Barrie. Because that's what we do, isn't it? Or worse, we're going to assume that it was somebody of a different ethnicity. Because that's what we do. But Jesus isn't interested in that either. He's not interested in the perpetrators of this crime. They don't matter. The people who matter in this story are the ones who show or fail to show mercy. That's what this story is about. The question is, who is my neighbor? And the answer has to do with who shows mercy. So that's what Jesus is interested in. The man doesn't matter. The robbers don't matter. The road to Jericho, between Jericho and Jerusalem, doesn't matter. Could be anywhere. What matters is that if it's a person in trouble, somebody just like you or me, is what Jesus is saying. And he's robbed by somebody just like you or me. Doesn't matter. And then people show up on the scene. And this is where it gets interesting. Because the first people who show up are the ones whose job it is to take care of people who are hurt. Okay, so the first person who walks by or drives by is a doctor. A person whose job it is to take care of those who are hurt. Doctor passes by, doesn't have the time. Maybe on their way to save somebody else, we don't know. Next person who passes by is a pastor. The person whose job it is to take care of those in need. Pastor passes by, doesn't have time, might be going to visit somebody else, might be on their way to church. We don't know, doesn't matter. Passes by on the other side of the street. A politician passes by. Person whose job it is to fix the system so that it's better and more just and reaches out and helps people in need, doesn't have the time. Might be going to sign a new law into effect that'll actually make a difference, but we don't know. That doesn't matter. That's not the point. They pass by on the other side of the road. But then a person from Barrie, a Section 8 recipient, a Samaritan, comes upon the scene. This is the person who's not supposed to help, not because they're from the wrong side of the tracks, not because they're from a different ethnic group or something like that. This is the person who's not supposed to help because they don't have the means. They don't have the power. They don't have the privilege or the position. It's not their job to help somebody else. And here comes this Samaritan who helps the man in trouble, tends his wounds, carries him to an inn, pays for his stay there. This is an important story, not because the Samaritan is somebody who's despised and who we don't expect. That's what we see in this story at first glance. We see, the person that we see as other is the one showing true godliness, true compassion. And we say, part of the story, yes, is that those whom we see as least godly or least like us can teach us how to be godly and how to be just. And that's important. But what's really key to me in this story is that the person who has the least resource to help is the one who brings the greatest mercy and justice. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever seen an instance where a person who's really poor, who has next to nothing, will take that next to nothing and share it with someone who is even more poor than they are, who has nothing? Whereas a person who's got everything in the world would be more hesitant to share that. Have you ever seen that happen? See it happen all the time, right? See it happen all the time. What the Good Samaritan knows and what makes him good is that he understands, he knows that you don't have to be a doctor to bind somebody's wounds. And you don't have to be a pastor to show compassion and tend someone who's in pain. And you don't have to be a politician to seek greater justice. And you don't have to be rich to help a person find a place to stay and care for them for the night and say to the innkeeper, if you spend more, let me know and I'll pay you on my way back. In short, you don't have to be the person whose job it is to fix this. You have to be the person whose heart is in it and who has hands ready to help. The people in the Upper Valley region, around White River Junction, I am sure that there are doctors and clergy and politicians and wealthy folks, that some of their donors are huge businesses who want that great and valuable opportunity of saying we support our community, and out of goodness and compassion and love and a searching for justice, do give and support this program. I'm positive. But I'm willing to bet you that the vast majority of the people, just by default, by definition, who give, and certainly the vast majority of the people who volunteer for this program, are ordinary folks. Samaritans themselves, perhaps, or this close to being Samaritans themselves. They are not professional caregivers. They are not professional assistants. With the exception of the 20 people hired by that program, it's not their job to make it better. But they're not going to wait for the doctor to show up on the scene and be able to help. They're not going to wait for the pastor to do the compassionate Christian thing. They're not going to wait, heaven forbid, for the politician to fix the system and get it right. I don't believe that Jesus is coming back tomorrow necessarily, but I think the end of the world will happen before we get that quite right in many senses of the words. We don't have to wait for the people who seem to be in charge or have power or privilege or wealth or status to fix the system. We're the ones who are walking down the street, and we're the ones who see the person in need. And what the Samaritan understands and what the folks in the Upper Valley understand is that we're not professional helpers and assistants, but we are the ones that God's called to be helpers and assistants. We are not the folks who are paid to do it, but we are the folks whose hearts burn until we do it. We cannot cope with the pain of seeing someone else suffer until we have lent a hand. We are not the people whose job it is, like the priest and the Levite, or the doctor and the lawyer and the politician and the wealthy person who seem to have the means and the opportunity to help. We are the people who are called by God to help. And when we do that, we show true justice and true mercy. We show that we are truly neighbors. The folks in Barrie and Montpelier who've been working on this problem, we face a lot of obstacles, and we get really daunted because it's such a huge task, and it's easy to be overwhelmed by that. It's incredibly easy to be it's almost impossible not to be overwhelmed by that. Or to say, well, it's somebody else's problem, we need to push this on to the legislature, or push this on to the community, the mayor, and things like that, so that there's help from somewhere above or somewhere outside us. Because it's easy to say that those are the folks who should do it. And we meet incredible resistance from parts of the community who say, not in our backyard, not one more program, not one more shelter, not one more thing. We're out of space, we're out of time, we're out of money, we're out of energy. But all we can do is pray that we be true Good Samaritans in our Good Samaritan haven, that we be the kind of place and the kind of community that recognizes what it is to be a neighbor. And what it is to be a neighbor is not to be the powerful ones and the ones who have the means to make it right, but to be the ones who have the hearts to make it right and to do the best we can with whatever olive oil and wine and couple of copper coins or silver coins we have, to bring a little bit of mercy and a little bit of justice to our neighbors. May we have the strength to do so. Amen.